Accession number 17747, reel 14.
You asked about how much I would know about the targeting, and I said that I would know it at the minimal level of being told where to fire and conveying these messages. And I noted in my diary that for the first time I was giving out real live firing instructions to the two gun troops, real firing at a real and very threatening enemy, and all very scary. I don't mean it was physically frightening, but it was you felt the responsibility of actually giving orders for live ammunition to be fired at live men.
But if something went wrong, you would be responsible.
Indeed, yes.
When you got an order coming into you, did it come into you from regimental headquarters, or could it come in as a request from the infantry?
It would come most usually. In the case of a Stonk, which was the words escape me as I get older, concentrated fire on fixed targets, this would be from RHQ, because they would be telling the other batteries to do it as well. But so far as there's a self-containment about a gunner battery, and you're not tied by the apron strings to RHQ, you are responding to your, as you rightly surmise, to your own infantry through your battery commander, who is with the infantry, or through the troop commander, who is with a particular company of infantry. So you either find in orders coming from the battery commander, who is with the colonel of the infantry, or with his permission, straight from troop commander down to the troop of guns from the observation post.
So the officer in the observation post would in effect be tasking the battery?
He would be tasking his own troop. He's a troop commander. You had two of those, and the battery commander was their boss. And between the three of them, they were the eyes and ears, if you like, of the battery, either at battery level or at the two troop level.
How long would it take you upon receiving orders for a stomp from regiment to actually pass those orders on down to the troops?
Well, it would be enormously quick. You would hope to be able to fire off, if necessary, within a minute, I would say, particularly if it was one which had been employed before, if it was a battery target numbered A, B or C, you would give the instructions accordingly.
You just pass the code word?
Yes, or whatever it was, back to, that's right.
Do you have any idea of how many of these pre-arranged targets you had in the battery?
I have no idea at this time, this distance in time, but quite a lot, because they had been, the guns were in the same position for some days after I arrived, and it doesn't take long to build up a stockpile of known good targets, or thought to be good targets. But I don't know how many.
Were you aware of any fire plans at higher level, in other words, divisional fire plans or corps fire plans, in which you had a part to play, preordained part?
Not at this stage, no. What I would have liked to know more about was the coordination between the American and the British, the two corps, and I don't know how far they merged their strategies down to the level of actual target firing. They were responsible for different segments of the two.
You had your own sectors of the...
We had our sectors of the bridgehead, yes. Although, of course, at the margins, and I think we were near one of the margins, our forward officers and our infantry were fighting alongside the Americans, and one heard stories. I suppose they were partial, and falsely patriotic about our officers having to order certain American troops back into the line when they were in retreat, because our people had been in action before and were battle-hardened, whereas for a lot of the Americans this was the very first contact with an enemy. This is no reflection on the Americans, except one of inexperience.
But you're inexperienced, weren't you?
Well, I was, but I mean my colleagues had been on this 3,000 mile march into action from Basra in Iraq, and they had become battle hardened in 3 months or so in Tunisia.
Well, were there any particular skills that they were able to pass on to you which were useful in return?
I don't think it would be skills so much. I mean, obviously there were skills, because we were newly in action. They knew the ropes about the practicalities of digging in and about what would be a sensible place to dig in. I mean, practice does help in things like line laying, knowing who to send out to lay the lines and how this could best be effected. I think my own sense of this was that they had experienced the fears before, which everybody has, and it was heartening to see how relatively casually they took nearby shells landing, which is a most horrendous experience to hear live shells being aimed at you and landing perhaps 100 yards away. They had, to an extent, learned to discount this, and this communicated itself to us.
Was this communicated to you in an explicit way, or simply...
Oh, no, subliminal, you know. It was, by the usual, like a baby learning to talk. It just follows those who can. And we knew that what to be frightened of and when to dive for cover from them.
So you were learning by imitation?
Oh, yes.
By instruction?
Oh, certainly. I mean, instruction was not the order of the day at all. We were regarded as members of the team almost from the first day, and we were expected to play our part, and that is perhaps the best way of learning, in at the deep end.
There was no period of adjustment?
No. We couldn't, you see, because we were replacing casualties. This was the essence of being first-line reinforcements, that we were taking the place of people who had gone either to hospital or had been killed.
How was the command post manned? Were you there on a shift system, or were you...
One was on duty all the time, and you took it in turns to have a bit of kip. But, there was no... I've noted one thing. You raise a good point, because the army had just acquired its first shower baths, and after about 3 or 4 days, two of us were allowed an hour and a half off, or whatever it was, to tramp a mile and a half to take a shower.
Mobile bath unit.
That's right, yes. I'm sure that's the right terminology. But
doesn't it mean that you actually lived in the command post as well as working there?
Oh, yes, certainly. Oh, yes, you lived on the job. There was no question of commuting to and from the job. You were on the job, and you had a bivouac perhaps just outside. I mean, if the command post was in a farmhouse or a big dugout, then your bivouac would be in a smaller one round the perimeter.
What about the soldiers, the signallers in particular? Were they on duty 24 hours a day, or were they...
They were on call. They would take it in turns and decide among themselves to how to allocate a few hours' sleep. Sometimes night was a quiet time. People could sleep, except for one or two people being on duty. Other nights I've noted that we were up all night. And so it went on. We did actually move our position, I've noted, on the 20th. We dug into a new forward position and I noted that it was a very crowded area, presumably a great many troops were waiting to burst out of the bridgehead as soon as we could.
When you did that move, was that done in daylight or was it done under cover of darkness?
I think what happened, and I'm speculating up to a point, but it would have made sense, and I think it happened this way, is that a party would go forward and dig in to prepare gun positions so that when the guns came out of their dugouts, they could go straight into new ones without having to hang about in the open whilst being dug in. It was fairly well prepared. I mean, the planning, I thought, was superb amid all this chaos and horror. This, of course, showed the dividend of good training and
presumably experience too.
And experience in the case of those who were experienced. It didn't take very long to become experienced.
You were saying you were under fire, that shells started landing near
you.
Yes. Do you think this fire was carefully directed counter-battery fire, or was it speculative?
Oh, I think it was counter-battery, because they could see the flashes from our guns and took their bearings from either physical observation from the distant hills or closer observation from flashes, from seeing our flashes.
Do you know what kind of weapons they were using to bombard your position?
They used a number of things, but 88mm was, of course, a common gun, and also quite a number of tanks were in action round our perimeter, Tiger tanks and the like. Panzer Mark V, I can't remember the numbers. They tried to put the fear of God into us and succeeded very largely through using the screaming Nebelwerfers, the mortars with, I think, about 9 barrels, which would come over and down like devils from hell coming out of the sky, the most awful noise, and it really was very frightening.
Normally it's medium artillery that is assigned the counter-battery role, as far as I know.
I suppose that's right, yes. What they had, I don't know. 105s, 155s.
Did they do any damage to your battery or inflict any casualties?
They didn't at this stage. There were some casualties, yes. Certainly casualties, but they tended to be among... Well, those I knew of had, when I arrived, had been among people who were with the infantry in the observation posts, where they had tended to be overrun or very nearly overrun.
So they were really victims of the enemy infantry, not the enemy
artillery. Oh yes, certainly, that's true. Yes, I did think we suffered greatly from... we certainly had no direct hits on our guns. Our guns came out of this unscathed.
What about your other facilities, the command post and the living quarters? That
I wish I could remember, but I don't remember any casualties near me on that score on account of accurate shelling, no.
I mean, were there prolonged and heavy bombardments?
Well, there was noise all the time. I mean, it was a very noisy business. Some nights were quieter than others, but some were absolute hell with salvos of gunfire and regular shells landing aimed at the same sort of spot, a crossroads where people might be expected. I mean, speculative firing. They were likely to hit something if they...
Well, in a crowded bridgehead, if you indulge in harassing and speculative firing, then you will hit
something, and a lot of damage was done. I mean, this was a serious business. A lot of men were wounded or killed, including some, obviously, some gunners. Somewhere I have a history of the regiment which probably says how many were killed. but it doesn't say where.
On this question of sleep, you're saying that you were in the gun, you were in the command post most of the time, and you would sleep when you could and leave each other. Have you any idea of roughly how much sleep you were getting on the 24-hour cycle?
Very little, but sleep became one of my main problems, not only in the war, but for the rest of my life as a result of the war. I've never learnt to sleep properly since, which gives some indication of the disruption to one's sleep pattern, which war or active service actually causes. It was all very irregular, bitty, and snatch it where you can, for the most part.
Did you find that this had an effect upon your performance?
I don't think so. I really don't think so, but one is not in the best position to judge one's own performance.
So you weren't conscious of any of
that? No. You when you're young, particularly, you very rapidly wake up, and also the adrenaline of action is huge. And when you did hit the blankets or the palliasse, you went out like a light if you had been up for 20 hours.
On this question of the adrenaline and so on, many veterans of action have said that they were very frightened, but the fear was overcome by excitement. Would that be a reasonable observation?
I think so, yes. The fear set in if you had an idle moment, if you were actually ordered to do something, and this was true a good deal of the time, then you were too busy to be frightened, though, of course, you were not too busy to be cautious. If you had any desire to survive the war, you watched your back, and you listened hard for anything coming towards you, and you got ready to dive. I think some people's tolerance of danger or perceived danger is greater than others. I think some people's tentacles are more sensitive than others, and mine on the whole were fairly sensitive, and I was of relatively nervous disposition, and I didn't like being frightened. And I was jolly careful as far as I could be. You know, if I saw, I would look pretty hard before I went the extra 50 yards to do a job across open ground. Some people didn't seem to give a damn. Some of those survived, some of them didn't. It's a matter of temperament, really. I had noted it already on the landing ship tank when we were dive-bombed coming into Salerno, that there was a very clear difference between those people who were able to stand up and watch or look out for the dive-bombers and those who were flat on the deck. And I was particularly struck by a young man who was, I don't know whether he's gunner or infantryman, a subaltern who happened to be, I knew him slightly, he happened to be the son of a bishop, and he acted as though he was immortal. I mean, he simply stood up and watched this battle whilst a lot of us, most of us, were cowering and trying to keep away from it. It is a temperamental difference, or possibly a religious difference, I don't know.
How long did it take you to learn to tell the difference between a shell that was going to land close to you and one that was going to land a safe distance away?
I don't think you could ever be sure, except there was a sense, your own physical senses told you about direction, whether something was really getting louder to the point of coming at you. But it was never foolproof. I think blanket shelling, you were fairly clear that if a stonk was coming down and then approaching you, a creeping barrage, you knew you were in for trouble, and this was a good time to start looking for cover. But this was just instinctive calculation. One of the frightening things I thought was airburst, because you didn't know, there was nowhere you could hide from it, except under the ground, which was not possible. Airbursting shells are very frightening.
What about your command post, though? Didn't that have overhead cover?
Oh, well, we had sandbagged. We sandbagged ourselves in as far as we could, but it...
Did it have a roof on it?
Well, it would only have a makeshift of canvas and the like. We were not in the building construction game, although usually, of course, we did try to find some kind of a building, a barn or something with a roof on it.
At some stages, I think it became quite common for when positions were dug in, the soldiers would put sheet of corrugated iron if they
could find one, yeah.
You know, earth on top or
yes, that's right.
A door or some other thing.
Yeah, that's right. It was makeshift. Yes, I mean you had to have cover, not for protection, because nothing would protect you from a medium gun shell landing on the roof, but it's because you needed the light. See, you just had to have good light, battery provided lights for reading the maps and giving the instructions and all that. You couldn't man a command post in the dark, in darkness.
So you had a blackout or something?
You had to have a blackout, and you had to have the battery provided lights adequate for reading quite small maps.
How was your feeding arranged when you were in the command post?
A large part of the time feeding, a large part of the time we were living off K rations, American Army K rations, or our own equivalent, whose name I've forgotten, Compo, I think it was. In other words, we were living off cold food with a brew up of tea.
How did the American rations compare to the British?
Oh, they're infinitely more sophisticated. They went right down to toilet paper, that sort of thing, which latest technology in compressing meat so that you would get something not much bigger than an OXO cube, which would build up into a stew, that kind of thing. I exaggerate, but it was very sophisticated and very complete. We were thrilled with the American K rations. Good biscuits and that kind of thing. The main deprivation, I ought to say straight away, is the lack of bread. And morale was tending to get lower and lower on the feeding front until we got the bakery established. And that took 2 or 3 weeks at least to get a bakery established. But good point. Yes, bread. Staff of life, it really is. Biscuits, no substitute.
Was there any possibility of local purchase or acquisition? You mentioned having a field of tomatoes for your first.
Well, of course, we would raid the fields, no problem for things like fruit. We were lucky in that respect. There's no danger of scurvy. But as to the shops, well, I mean, there wasn't a shop in the bridgehead. There was hardly a civilian. I mean, it was a pathetically devastated countryside.
The civilian population had gone.
They'd gone, although there were odd ones around. I mean, I have noted on the 21st, which is a week after I landed, that we heard somebody ringing the bells from churches for St. Matthew's Day, and that people were beginning to flock back to their desolated homes. Presumably the Germans were letting them through, and our forward troops were letting them through, all very poor peasant types. No sleep, pooped off a hell of a lot of shells. This suggests a night of target shooting. And then, sorry.
Was there a lot of activity at night? Because some fronts, apparently the Germans were rather disinclined to do things at night, and other areas they seemed to have been more active.
Well, this was a pretty active place. I mean, one has to remember that the Germans had Hitler at their back telling them to drive us into the sea. No doubt they had divisional commanders and brigade commanders and so on, who felt that their jobs were on the line, and that time was limited. You don't, I mean, the longer a bridgehead is there, the less likely you are to be able to drive it back into the sea. And this had been there by now. I'm talking about 21st of September. This is from the 9th. It had been there 12 days. So you could, they could assume that we were getting fairly well dug in.
And reinforced, too.
And reinforced, as indeed they were. We were. Surrounded by grapes, tangerines, and American medium guns, I note, on the 22nd. Smoked cigarettes and eat chocolates and walnuts. Now, the chocolate was, of course, American K-ration.
Do you remember any powerful impressions of the Americans? You mentioned the medium guns. And
yes. My most powerful impression is that of going along and spending half a day doing some business, which I can't remember, with the Americans at a divisional headquarters. And it must have been early in the morning, because I had breakfast with them, and it took me a long time to recover from the shock of having marmalade with bacon. But that I remember very clearly. But they were very friendly. The thing I noted, I think already, and certainly I noted it later in the American Fifth Army, was the slight, not truculence, but the distance that there seemed to be between the whites and the blacks. And it produced a kind of mute resistance on the part of the undervalued black troops. So that if you, I remember being lost on a motorbike and coming across a lorry load of black Americans and asking them the way, and they were not very helpful. And at the time I was puzzled by it. It didn't occur to me, as it did later, that perhaps they all had a bit of a chip, particulars as far as young officers were concerned.
When you changed positions, went from your first position in the bridgehead perimeter to the second, do you remember what direction you moved in? Were you moving forward?
Oh, we were moving forward, yes. Yes, we were gradually inching forward the boundaries of the beachhead. Its worst time had been about the night or the night before I landed.
The early days.
The early days. The first week was very hairy, and after 4 or 5 days, there was a perilous situation, and troops were actually pulling back. But after about, I can say after I landed, the two are not related, it began to inch slightly forward. Oh, right.
You're saying that the perimeter was being pushed outwards.
Yes, that's right. By the 23rd of September, which was 9th, it would be 2 weeks after the first landing, the fighting, I've noted, the fighting was still stiff, but we're slowly advancing. The guards, for example, a lot of people have gone out on a forward recce, and I'm left alone in the charge of the command post, and I helped to give orders for the guns to shoot all night via the two troops, 4 guns each, that is. And between times, I read Wells's Short History. Did get a reasonable amount of sleep between times. Then 24th, Friday, wait all morning for orders, then eventually move out of the bridgehead at 1300 hours. Turn north from Salerno and up a narrow, treacherous valley of sun-blackened corpses. I shall never forget that, because it was a horrendous experience. In the same way as a convoy of trucks these days would have to pass by a parked car or a broken-down car on the side of the road, so we had to file past at about 2 miles an hour. Such was the volume of traffic. round the bare corpse of a guardsman, and we first smelt him from about 300 yards away, and the smell became steadily worse as we got towards him and peeled round his body, which was visibly crawling with maggots. And all he had on was a pair of boots and a pair of socks, and the rest was alive. He was black, jet black. It's only later, the day later, that we found out that this horror was booby-trapped.
How did you know he was a guardsman?
I don't know. It's a very good question, but we did know. I think because that had been the advance route of the guards along that particular axis. It may be that there was a guard's hat near him with the insignia on. Also, an enormous chap. But that's that would be stretching matters.
Well, all guardsmen are enormous chaps. Yeah. Enormous chaps are guards.
No, so they precisely so. The syllogism is faulty. But anyway, we assumed it was a guardsman, and I think we were probably right. Also, there were landmines all over to be avoided. This was really our first, not our first contact with death, because I had seen dead Germans in scout cars in the bridgehead itself, but it was the first contact with what happens after death.
With decomposition?
Yes.
How much warning did you have that you were going to move forward after the perimeter? Do you remember?
Well, I would guess that we must have known.